With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and our connection to our own humanity. This is episode 59, another joint episode with Melita Thomas of Tudor Times on Anne of Denmark. Just to note that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network, and the Agora Podcast of the Month is the History of Islam Podcast, which is available at historyofislampodcast.blogspot.com or all of the general podcasty sorts of places like iTunes and Pocket Casts. So again, the History of Islam Podcast. We also have a really special giveaway going on for the next week. So Tudor Times has just launched a brand new shop filled with all kinds of cool stuff inspired by Tudor architecture. And there's a great quotes range as well. So if you go to englandcast.com and check out the giveaway post, there's also an image on the page. We're doing a giveaway to be entered to win a set of 4 Elizabeth I quote mugs. So these are mugs, a set of mugs that have quotes by Elizabeth I. And they are a fantastic way to start your morning with your coffee or end your day with your chamomile tea or whichever you prefer, or both. So go to englandcast.com to enter, and you can enter until next Friday, the 11th. Yeah, the 9th and 11th of November. So if you're listening to this after that, I'm sorry you've missed out. The early bird catches the worm. Okay, so moving on from the admin bit, let's talk about Anne of Denmark now. Let me first introduce you to Melita. Melita is a co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history in the period from 1485 to 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. Melita, who has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970 series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, also contributes articles to BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine. We started the interview with me asking her why Anne was special and why she chose her as the person of the month.
Very interesting cultural influence, not so much in Scotland because Scotland was quite a poor country. But once she became Queen of England, she really raised the cultural tone of the English court, they called it Great Britain by then, because James was very keen to be known as King of Great Britain. So he and Anne called themselves King and Queen of Great Britain. And she sort of put it culturally back on the map after Elizabeth, who, although, you know, there'd been a great deal of cultural innovation in Elizabeth's reign with Shakespeare and Ben Jonson and all the rest of them, her court wasn't quite so cultured as Anne's interests were. So that's why Anne's interesting. Also, she was the daughter of the King of Denmark. He was King of Denmark and Norway, and her brother Christian of Denmark became quite an influential king in the early 17th century. So, again, it was a time when Great Britain was moving back into a relationship with Europe after the sort of 40 or 50 years after the Reformation, when it was, you know, much more isolated. So she's interesting, actually. And her domestic relationships, they seem curiously modern in some ways, her relationship with her husband. So that's all proved quite interesting.
Tell me about her life. What was her early life like before she came to Scotland? And she seems to have been really close to her family. How did that influence her relationship with her own children? You mentioned her court being, or her relationships being kind of modern. Tell me about that.
Yeah, she was the second daughter of Frederick II. He was king of Denmark and Norway, as I said, and his wife was Sophie of Mecklenburg-Güstrow, which is one of those many, many small German principalities that are in northern Germany. And Queen Sophie, she was a very influential figure in Denmark, although she was only 17 when Anne was born. But she was unusually close to her parents, who frequently visited the Danish court. The Danish royal children spent, and including Anne, spent some of their childhood at their grandparents' home in Germany. And there seems to have been a much more frequent visiting backwards and forwards of the families, much more time spent together than is normal with royal families of the period, because frequently a daughter would marry and, you know, she'd never see her parents again. But Queen Sophie's parents, went backwards and forwards. And Sophie herself was very attached to her children. She breastfed them herself, which raised a few eyebrows at the time. Yes. And this obviously influenced Anne in that she seems to have had a good relationship with her brother, who later came to visit her in England when she was Queen of England. And in fact, led to one of the biggest quarrels she ever had with her own husband about the upbringing of her children. She wanted to keep them very close to her and bring them up as she'd been brought up in the sort of family. But the custom in Scotland was certainly for the oldest son to be brought up quite separately from the court, mainly for his own protection, because the Scottish monarchy had been quite troubled over the last 100 years. Obviously, Mary Queen of Scots had become queen as a baby, and there were threats of kidnapping. Then when James himself became king as a baby, there was the potential for him to be abducted. So it was thought to be very important that the heir be kept very safe. But Anne was completely horrified when James said that her little boy was going to be taken from her and brought up separately. Mm-hmm. She was distraught, had a miscarriage, had a, you know, complete, almost a breakdown. It's awful, because you can see James's point of view. He wanted to keep the child safe, but Anne, it was just so outside her experience. And she was only, you know, she was still quite young when her first child was born. James did relent, and not in relation to their oldest son, but their younger children were, she had much more influence and control of their lives than of her oldest son. Mm. But yeah, no, quite sad for her that.
Yeah. Well, what was her relationship like with James, and how did it change throughout the years and once they got to England?
There was about 8 years difference in their age group. She was about 14 or 15 when they got married, and he was in his early 20s. But they had both in line with the custom of the time, they both decided before they got married that they were very much in love, and they sent each other formal letters. And when it was rumoured that the marriage wouldn't take place, it was said that Anne would die of grief if it didn't take place. So that they framed their minds to be in love, and that was a good thing. You were supposed to love your spouse, so they tried to do that. And certainly to begin with, they seemed to have been very fond of each other. They had 10 pregnancies Anne had. So although James's sexuality has been the subject of questioning, and I think we talked about it on a previous occasion, you know, he did manage to give his wife 10 babies, which would suggest, he wasn't as averse to women's company as all that.
Right.
She had 3 sons. Unfortunately, one died as a baby, and her eldest died at 18. And they had 5 daughters who were born, and there were some miscarriages. So they had a big family. So to begin with, they were quite close, but there was an age gap between them. James was very highly educated, and although Anne, we don't know much about her actual education, she spoke French, which she learnt especially so that she and James could converse when they first met. Her first language was probably Danish or German, and she learnt Scots after she married. But she didn't have the academic education that James had, so they probably weren't intellectually that close. What makes me say it's kind of like a modern marriage is that when he talked about marriage in the book he wrote for his son, he said that marriage is the greatest earthly felicity or misery that can come to a man. And he complained when she became Queen of England and appointed new ladies in waiting. He complained that, you know, he didn't like her choice. He didn't like her friends. She complained that he drank too much, you know, and sort of neglected her. And then her chaplain said that they did love as well as man and wife could do after they stopped sleeping together, which seems to have been about 1606. Mm-hmm. So they rubbed along pretty well, but, you know, there were quite frequent rows, and then they'd make up and he'd give her a present and then they'd have another row, and, you know, a bit like, you know, Darby and Joan, really.
Right. Interesting. When she got to England, how was she received, and did she have any kind of power over policy or over James by the time they got to London?
Not really. I mean, in the 1590s in Scotland, she had, I mean, Scottish politics was very factional in that period. And with her dislike of the Earl of Mar, who was the guardian of the young prince, she really took against him. She did become slightly involved in politics. She disliked James's chancellor, Maitland, Sir John Maitland, partly because he had tried to block the marriage. He didn't want James to marry Anne. So when Anne found out, she seems to have been able to bear a grudge a bit. Mm-hmm. She never forgave Mar. She never forgave Maitland. Also, Maitland tried to hang on to some property that James had given Anne, and he refused to hand it over. Mm. But when Anne fell pregnant, she put pressure on James to put Maitland in his place, so he did. And then the biggest political issue was the belief that she'd converted to Catholicism. Now, it's never been definitively proved that she did actually formally become a Catholic, but in Calvinist Scotland, this was not, you know, not a good thing. And James himself seems to have had no interest in forcing other people's religious beliefs. He was born and brought up a Protestant, as Anne had been, and he never wavered in that. But, you know, for Anne to become a Catholic was definitely a bad publicity for him. So she didn't make an open declaration about it. But there was some disquiet in England when she refused to take communion according to the Anglican rite at her coronation. Mm. So people weren't very happy about that. Mm. But she didn't have much political power, partly possibly the age gap. Also, James thought very well of his own opinions, and he wasn't necessarily going to be influenced by a much younger wife. So she turned her attention really to what you might call soft power. She was very, very interested in cultural matters. She was interested in architecture, in painting, in music and dance. And her role sort of became to make the English, or the Great British Court, as they thought themselves, a sort of cultural icon rather than get involved in political power. She did have some influence in regard to the marriage of her sons. When brides were being looked for, first for Henry, the Prince of Wales, who died in 1612, and then for Prince Charles, there are letters in the European archives that suggests that Anne was very much in favour of a marriage to a Catholic princess for either of her sons. And the European monarchs seemed to think she was worth influencing if they could. Mm-hmm. So she was obviously felt to have some power over James, but it wasn't huge.
So tell me about her patronage of the arts. And you mentioned architecture. I know Inigo Jones and all of that.
Yes. Inigo Jones was her protege, definitely. She worked with him not just in architecture on the large scale, refurbishing Whitehall. I mean, sadly, the banqueting house that is there now postdates Anne's life. The first banqueting house, which was built just after she died, burnt down. Mm. So what we see now isn't Anne's, but, you know, probably there is some of her influence in it. And also the original Queen's House at Greenwich was built for Anne, but again, it was remodeled later for her daughter-in-law, Henrietta Maria. Mm. But Inigo Jones didn't just build buildings. He was right-hand man for the sets and scenery and stage settings for the great masks that the Queen favoured. And these were enormously sumptuous productions of dance and music and play acting, costumes were created of, you know, quite extraordinary extravagance and beauty, and scenery was built, and music was written, and dances were choreographed, and Inigo Jones created a number of the different costumes. You can see pictures of them in the V&A collection. Really, really fabulous costumes. Then another great interest she had was jewellery. She loved jewellery, and I think that was a taste she got from her mother, who, when she first married, gave her an enormous amount of jewellery, particularly pearls. Mm. And James also gave her quite a bit of jewellery. And when she inherited Elizabeth I's massive wardrobe, you can see she's permanently draped in pearls, mm-hmm. as most of the 16th century women loved pearls, ladies, and Anne, she's got them all over the place. And if you look at some of her portraits, you can see rather interesting jewellery. So she spent quite a bit of money. She had a jewellery maker, a goldsmith called George Herriot from Edinburgh, who she brought to England with her to keep manufacturing stuff for her. She also painting the visual arts. Three of the great painters whom she patronised were Marcus Gerhardts, who painted some very large full-size portraits of her, of James, of their children, and he was her official Queen's painter and was in her funeral procession as the Queen's painter. She also patronised Sir Isaac Oliver, who at the right at the other end of the scale did the tiny, tiny little miniatures on ivory that we associate with the end of Elizabeth's reign and the beginning of, the Jacobean period. She patronised Paul von Sommer, another Netherlandish painter. She seems to have liked the Dutch and Netherlandish styles, which became increasingly popular. And you can see this taste transferred to her son, Charles I, who was also, one of the greatest art collectors in British royal history. He created, fantastic collection. I would suggest that he was heavily influenced by his mother in this. And then there was the other painter who was considered to be James's painter. So she had Gerhardts and James had Daniel Mittens, another Netherlandish portraitist. But there's a lot of portraiture from the Jacobean period that, I think Anne is probably responsible for, because, of course, once the Queen thinks it's fashionable, everybody's following suit. Sure. Outside the masks, there was also the more ordinary plays and so forth. She and James both enjoyed plays, and they had their own, the King's Men, who had once been Shakespeare's company, and the Queen had her own players. She was good friends with Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke, who was a noted author herself and also the centre of a large group of sort of cultural of poets and playwrights and so forth. Mm. And she introduced the Queen to Ben Jonson. It was a whole sort of cultural melee of things that Anne was interested in.
How has her reputation changed throughout the years?
You can definitely see it undergoing change. She was never much talked about in the past, and then when the great 19th century and 20th century historians, the Whig tradition of history, they're all very, very interested in wars and treaties. They're not really interested in wider social history. And I think in the last 15, 20 years, as we've become much more interested in what I called before soft power and cultural history and material culture, Anne is now being seen as having a much more important place than just, James's wife, who was supposed to be delivering children from time to time. Mm-hmm. So there is much more interest in the kinds of things that she did and that she promoted. Sadly, there doesn't seem to be a modern biography of her. There is a cultural biography of her that was published in 2000. By somebody called Leeds Barrell, which is an unusual name and I haven't come across before, but it was very much looking at the cultural aspects rather than her as an individual. But yeah, so she was frequently written off as frivolous and extravagant and, money wasting. And again, the sort of traditional Whig historian, they're pretty ambivalent about her Catholic leanings, to say the best. I think she's right. Going to come into her own, actually. I think I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a biography of her or more interest in her as people become much more interested in how people lived rather than just the politics and the high politics of the time. Her time has come.
And you're contributing to that.
Well, hopefully, yes. I'm the more I read, I mean, one of the other aspects of it that's not so attractive, although I haven't any evidence about Anne's thoughts on the matter, was the whole witchcraft piece. James became very concerned about witchcraft, and it was partly based on his experience of his marriage to Anne, because when she was married by proxy, and
there was the storm, right?
Storm,
tell me about it.
Yeah, so she was married by proxy, and James was back in Scotland, and the plan was that she would sail to Scotland and all would be well, but she set off late-ish in the year for a trip from Norway to Scotland in a large fleet. She would travelled with 18 huge ships full of horses and jewels, and she had a silver coach. Well, I mean, the coach wasn't literally made of silver, you know, like Cinderella, but the coach, uh-huh, which was a very modern invention, never seen in Scotland before, had, instead of being the metalwork being iron, it was all silver.
Huh.
So she set off with this enormous train of 18 ships and ran into storms and was beaten back to the coast of Norway at least twice. And she ended up in Oslo, poor thing, you know, sick and traumatized. It's proposed that she would set out in lighter vessels, that they'd be able to make it. And there was a bit of argument. The Scots said, yes, just get into a small ship. And her Danish train said, no, wait till spring. But Anne said, no, she would go on. She'd go on to Scotland. But James decided that it would be much safer if he went to fetch her himself. So off he went, being somewhat romantic in his view. He thought he was in love and he was dying to see his new bride. Went off to Norway, where Anne had landed. And then they travelled to Denmark together, and then they got married and so forth. But when they came back, he came to believe that the storms had been whipped up by witches. Because it wasn't just the ships that Anne was travelling in that had been, you know, damaged by storms, but a small boat crossing the Firth of Forth with Lady Kennedy in it, who was appointed to wait on the new queen, that sank as well with, 40 passengers and plate and jewels and furniture all being prepared for Anne. And he became convinced that it was witchcraft, partly because the Danish admiral, whose name was Peter Munk, gave out that he thought the storms had been brewed up by the wife of somebody he had quarrelled with, who was reputed to be a witch. So this all then, it literally was a perfect storm. So with the loss of Lady Kennedy, some of the ships, the rumours that it was witchcraft, another rumour that one of James's nobles, the Earl of Bothwell, was considered to be, or his family were considered to been dabbling in witchcraft, sort of led to the great witch hunts. And we have to remember that people did believe in witchcraft, and some people really did believe that they themselves were witches. It wasn't necessarily that it was just other people accusing people. Some people genuinely, you know, thought that they could brew up storms and do things like that, and which obviously we don't tend to think nowadays. So this all, you know, really got quite out of hand, and there were huge witch hunts which might have happened anyway, but certainly were. This was a sort of a catalyst for James taking an interest in the whole witchcraft thing.
So where can we go to learn more about her?
There isn't much published about Anne herself. She mostly just comes through as a character in biographies of James or sort of general histories of Scotland. One of the sidelights on Anne occurs in the book Unnatural Murder, about the famous murder of Thomas Overbury.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, now you've got my interest all piqued.
I'm right about that sometime. It's most peculiar. Yeah, Unnatural. It's by Anne Somerset. She's quite a heavy writer, but she's certainly got a lot of detail in there.
Thank you again to Melita Thomas for taking the time to tell us about Anne of Denmark. For more information on her, go to tudortimes.co.uk. You can also see the resources available on the Englandcast site at englandcast.com. And also remember to go there by the 11th of November to enter the giveaway for the quote mugs. I will be back next week with an episode on another Anne of Cleves. This is a listener request from Hannah, so I'm working on that for you, Hannah. All right, stay tuned, and in the meantime, have an awesome week, you guys. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, a sandal may be sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ye
sich hot aboard in Bauer bricht, at solis emlis on sich, men's cool maiden of nicht fair and freight of fonder, in all this worthliche one aboard of blood and of bone, never yet in Ooster known, not somewhere in London, blow northern wind, send for maybe's waiting, blow northern.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.